Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read. As I read it, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. This is another special guest, a special episode here. I've got my girlfriend Juliana. Say hi.
Hi.
And so we're going to be doing a full-on epic review of Dune, all spoilers included and everything like that. But first, a little bit of news. A few less podcasts than normal recently, but thanks for all the emails that people are sending in. You can send me emails, luke@juggler.net. And also, of course, you can follow me on goodreads.com and keep up with my reading there. I realized one of the reasons why I didn't have as many epic podcast episodes is because I read a few books. I read a book and just totally forgot about it. And then Amazon said, "Hey, what do you think of this book?" You know, obviously not many people have reviewed that book, and I was like, "Oh yeah, I just totally forgot." I think Goodreads.com I mentioned it, but I actually just completely then forgot to do that episode. So I'll get to that. It's a book about iPods and iPhones and stuff, which I'll get onto later. And I've got another book that I wanted to read. There's one by Michael J. Sullivan, which is called the Sword Conspiracy or something like that, the Crown Conspiracy. And I'd read the first book in a little two book collection of his, and then he sent me an email saying, "Hey, I've been listening to your podcast. I've enjoyed it. How about you check out this book?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm already done there." So once I read that second half of that, or the second story in this little two book collection, I'll review that as well. I've got some other books to review. What was the other one that I just finished? Kiln People by David Brin. I just finished that this morning as an audiobook. Really enjoyed that, except for a few little niggling bits at the end. But I've got a lot of books to review. Another book that I'm reviewing is The Bible. I've mentioned a few times I've been working on this new project, and one of the one project that I'm working on, which I'm starting to publish now on a blog, is a review. Not so much a review of the Bible, but an investigation into source criticism of the New Testament, specifically the books Matthew, Mark, and Luke in the New Testament, looked at through the eyes of the science fiction saga known as Star Wars. So I'm doing a Star Wars and biblical criticism combined book, which is like an introduction to biblical criticism, using Star Wars as a tool, as an analogy and stuff like that. So if you want to read that, there's a website which I've kind of set up, not just for this project, but for other biblical criticism things. It's called productivebiblegeeks.net. So if you go to productivebiblegeeks.net and click on Matthew, Mark, Luke, Skywalker, which is the working title of the book, Matthew, Mark, Luke, Skywalker, you can check out my writings there. I've got about a third of it written, and as I'm going through the first third of it, the first few sections of it, and editing it, I'm putting it up there. So, and there's other projects. What's the other one? Yes, the Groundhog Day musical that I've been written. So I just thought I'd mention all this at the beginning because me and Juliana, we are a nerdy kind of couple here. And it's just amazing how often our conversations suddenly go blah, 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 blah. And then we'll both like start talking about music or blah, 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 blah. And because I'm working on these different projects for Star Wars and the Bible and Groundhog Day, and of course we just went to watch The Hobbit the other day as well, and we're thinking of doing a review of that, of the Hobbit in the future. We just keep talking about all these really nerdy subjects, and then of course to get really into the science fiction nerdiness, we decided to do a review of Dune. Yes. So should we talk a little bit about the ways that we've consumed Dune first, or should we get straight on with the story? Or should we talk a bit about this one?
Yes.
Okay, so what happened is back when we were traveling through Africa, I listened to the audiobook of Dune, which was really good fun, and I mentioned it there. And then when we were starting to read some other books and other bits and pieces, Juliana was saying, "Well, what book should I read that you've reviewed so far on the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast?" And I said, "Well, Dune, that's a good one, it's a classic." So tell them about the version of Dune that you read.
So first of all, I downloaded the English audiobook as well.
Yeah, you just used my copy from Audible, yeah.
And then you said, "Oh no, don't do that. That's way too confusing and you're never quite sure what characters," and so many characters there. And
yeah.
So I decided to get a German book.
Yep.
And I decided to get a German paper book. And I decided to get an older book because, like, you know, older books, it's, like, really nice. And
yeah,
you get it from the used bookshops, like the
yeah,
so secondhand bookshops. And I got a version, like a German
translation.
Publisher from the 1960s, I think.
Yeah, this was the second printing. No, 1971. So it's the 1971 German translation of Dune.
Exactly. And I read it. And I was, while reading it, I mentioned to Luke, hey, well, there are some really big unexpected cuts.
Well, no, you actually said, oh, it's really fast moving. Yeah, this is what you said. So it's really fast moving. And the thing is that, like, Dune is pretty much known for, like, really picking up after the first 300 or 400 pages or so that. That's when the story really starts getting going. You're saying, oh, it's really quick. They just go out here and then they're doing this and then they're moving on. And I was like, oh, really? So I wasn't quite sure what you meant by that, but what you were getting at with that idea. And then, of course, I said, make sure that you read this set, make sure you read back over this set conference where, of course, if you've read this book, we'll do a non-spoiler section beforehand, before we get onto the spoilers. But if you've not read this book, there's this one scene where they're sitting, the main characters and, Paul and his parents and lots of people sitting around a table, a conference table, having a banquet.
Yeah.
And it starts off and it pretty much sets up the entire all of the political maneuverings that have been going on up until then is set up. All of the stuff, all of the main characters who are going to be needed to play through to the end with Liet Kynes and the Fremen and these other things, they have representatives there. And it shows just how powerful the spice is and how, on Arrakis, how much water is powerful and all that kind of stuff. And it shows how Paul Atreides is like hero. He's like hero material. He's like that kind of stuff. And you think, I was just going to set up everything. And I was like, this is really important because you see inside him. We'll talk about that scene later. And then it turns out it wasn't in the book.
It wasn't in the book.
Yes.
So I read it through from the beginning to the end. And then I thought, well, we actually started almost doing
a podcast. We sat down to do a podcast.
And then I said, okay, let me just read through that chapter again. And I looked
and we couldn't find it.
And it wasn't there. So, and then I thought, maybe there's more missing than just that chapter. And it turned out it's like
abridged
version. Like it's an abridged version of it. It's maybe like half of it.
Yeah, it's half of it. Look, here it's 319 pages. When she showed me the book, I didn't really think about it, because it's just a paperback. I didn't really go, oh, let me check if that's an abridged version or not, because it doesn't say anywhere it's an abridged. And here, it says here, it's like 600. And the ebook version, the English ebook version that you actually did then download and read again, is 634 pages. So we're talking like half of the page missing from the German translation. And when you actually looked on Amazon.com, when you actually went back to check it, it was lots of people mentioned that in the review, didn't they? They said it's been missing.
Yeah, and also it's mentioned on Wikipedia about these German publishers in the 60s and 70s. It's normal that at this time.
It was like a standard thing.
It's a standard thing to actually publish science fiction books, but like not having to spend too much money on it because it's a massive book. So they just, translate it. And while translating it, we just cut out some scenes.
Or they just translate the abridged version or something like that. I'm not even quite sure.
No, I think they had the original,
they cut it themselves.
And they just cut it together.
But it doesn't say anywhere on the book that it's abridged.
No, nowhere.
So what we did is that you then read the English book again.
Yes.
And that you finished it today. And there was a lot of stuff missing from the German version.
Yes.
But now did you read all of it, or did you skip forward some of the sections that you'd already read?
Yeah, actually, some parts that are not that catchy, and then I just skipped some of the stuff which I already read and I knew what's going on. But some stuff was actually really new for me.
Yeah, but like some of the stuff that we'll talk a bit more as we go through the story. We'll talk about what was included in these different versions or what was cut out. And then last week we decided, hey, what we should do is we should watch the it was a few weeks ago, wasn't it? Yeah. We decided, well, we should watch the movie version as well. So we from the local video shop we borrowed the 1984 version of the film, but because it's a really old DVD. That they have there was only one audio track, because this happens on quite a few of these old DVDs. They only have like there's things that are published in German in Germany, these old DVDs, they again maybe just to save money or whatever, it's just that there was only one version. So then we watched the German dubbed translation, like the German version of the 1984 movie, which, spoiler, terrible movie. Well, again, we'll get onto that a bit later as well. And then I thought, well, I'll talk about the board game, because since I last reviewed Dune, I think Dune was one of the books that I reviewed like pretty early on in the SFBRP. So if you just want to set like the normal kind of style of review that I normally do here on the podcast, if you want that kind of review, go back and check out, let me see if it's going to come up here, an earlier episode where I reviewed Dune, which is, it comes up here, bum, 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 Frank Herbert, where are you? Oh, I can't even see it. Let's just do Dune. Oh yeah, 100. Oh yeah, episode 11. And episode 11, I gave Dune 4.5 out of 5 stars then, and it was a half hour long episode. And I think at the time, yeah, it was by far the longest episode of the Science Fiction Book Review podcast I'd ever done. And I was like, oh, this is really great because it's a really good book. It's really easy to rant about books that you don't like, but then again, it's really good to do a really in-depth study. And I said stuff in that podcast which I'd never really heard other people talk like say or write about when talking about Dune before. So I thought that was one of my favorite early episodes, and but I wasn't planning on doing this review again. But then audio version, film version, German abridged translation, the English book, and also the board game. So yes, since then I played the board game, and the board game is actually quite a legendary board game in the board game world, because it was the board game, let me just check here, so it was for 1979, but then it went out of print, so people now, they actually make their own versions of Dune, the board game, because it's, you know, it's really popular. Oh, or maybe in 2007 it was said it was going to be this is a different Parker Brothers. So there's an Avalon Hill board game and then a Parker Brothers board game. So there's different kinds of board games. So one of the main points of this board game is that each player picks, it's a 6-player game, and each player picks, I think they either pick or do they draw cards? I can't remember. But they each pick a faction from, which is known from the book or from the movie or from any version of Dune that you want to play. And the but you're not all equal. Each of these factions has different powers. They have different capabilities. So just from Wikipedia here, it says, House Atreides, there's a bidding section. It says, in many cases when bids are performed, it says that a Atreides player may use their prescience, which is, you know, to view the object of bidding. So there's a everyone's bidding on a card and nobody can see what the card is, except the player who's playing House Atreides, and they can just check it out and go, ah. And then they can either bid on it to make other people bid like it, and then like back out the bid to make people bid for a worthless card. Or if they, you know, if they really want it, they can keep bidding and other stuff. And they have these other ways to, you know, just if there's cards laying face down, people, you know, what's going to be the next card drawn? They can just pick up the card and just look at it and put it back down again. So they just know what's going to be happening on the next few turns, or all the way through that next turn. And then the Bene Gesserit. And these are a faction. These are obviously the factions in the book. If you've read the book, you'll know these. But the House Atreides is the House of Paul. It's like the main characters, or, you know, the main good guys. And the Bene Gesserit are the House of Women. These female priestesses, kind of things, who've got this Messiah breeding program going on. Is that the right yeah, term? Is that a good way to look at it? So they're over hundreds and hundreds of generations, they're trying to produce a new form of like human evolution, the next step in human evolution, where people can be prescient, people can see into the future and use all these skills that have been bred into them and trained into them over generations and generations and generations. And they, you know, in the Bene Gesserit, they marry their people into these different families. So in the board game, they kind of ally themselves. And one of the cool things is that if at the end of the beginning of the game, they say who is going to win and on which turn they're going to win out of the 15 turns that you have on this board, on this thing. So they just go, yes. So on turn number 12. This person is going to win. This faction is going to win. And if they do, that faction doesn't win, but the Bene Gesserit win. And so all the time they're trying to make other people win. And you just go, what? Why is this? And then the Emperor just can use twice as many of the military units as possible, you know, as anybody else. So anybody else buys that. And when they, it says here, when the other players buy a treachery card, they pay the Emperor. So the Emperor's just got loads of money coming. And you think, wait, this means these people are obviously going to win. And then the Fremen, they can actually move around the board much faster when a storm's creeps past. They don't, you know, they can check out where the storm is going, and they suffer half losses from the storm, and they don't need to pay to move their armies to Arrakis, to the planet Dunes, because they're already there. And it's one of those things of if a worm appears, and if any other troops are there, except the Fremen troops, they all get wiped out. But if the Fremen troops are there, it's like, they don't only not get killed, they can then ride the worm to anywhere else on the board. And it's just like, wow, this is so powerful. And then the Spacing Guild, when anything is transported to Dune, you pay the Spacing Guild, and then they don't have to pay for it. They don't have to pay for their own transport. And then House Harkonnen, when the player buys a treasury card, they get more treasury cards, and it says and when there's these different traitors and stuff. So the House Harkonnen, this other, you know, the main bad guy faction. So you've got these six different factions in the book, and they're all playing off each other, and they've all got their own unique things. And I think this is a real strength of the board game, and also what makes this board game like legendarily complex and things. And I've only ever played one game of it. It lasted like 3 hours, 3.5 hours, and you continually have different alliances. So I was allied with this one guy at one point, and it's really annoying because he was like the stereotypical super annoying board game nerd kind of person, and he would like have all his cards laid out on the table and be like, oh, I'm not doing this, and then instead of just sort of like whispering across the table or passing a note, he would get up, run around to my side of the table, and they'd just be whispering like, oh, what are we gonna do, what are we gonna do? And I was just like, oh, for fuck's sake, let's just move on. And in the end, I like wanted to lose just to make sure this guy lost as well. I can't remember the outcome of the game, but you don't just have alliances of two figures, you can have alliances of, I think, up to five. So in the end of the game, five different factions can all win against one faction. So you can have one losing faction and one winning faction in the board game. And I think once you understand that, you can kind of understand what's going on in the book at the same time. You're thinking, well, who is the winner at the end of this book? And that's the kind of thing. No spoilers there, but like I say, these are the main factions in the book there, and in the board game. But each of them, and like I say, this is the strength of the book, is that each of the factions isn't just, they're not equal. Like, so often you read this, it's sort of like, hey, I'm a king, and I want to be king over here. And someone else is like, yes, but I'm a prince, and I want to be king over there. Oh, and I'm this, and I want to be king over there. And the whole book is about who is king over there. And they're all just fighting their way over there to be king. And there's not a lot to tell apart. You know, this is a bit of a Game of Thrones criticism. It's like, for the people on the ground, who are the real people? You know, who are they, like, who is fighting, you know, who are they fighting for, and why should they care what is going on there at all? So there's lots of different factions. The board game is a lot of fun and unique in that the factions, like each player is totally overpowered in some way, and yet somehow is balanced out by the alliances between other factions. So what should we do? Should we go more through the book? That was me talking. You not played the game, so you don't know anything about it.
No, but that actually makes a lot of sense to have these different alliances. Because it's actually what's happening in the book. Yeah. You think, oh, these guys are having an alliance. And then you see, oh, no. And
these guys?
This guy's well is in there. And then people change in between the alliances.
And everybody contributes something different to the alliance. And in the same way as this, it's like the Bene Gesserit, are they like, whose side are they on? You're never really sure. The main Bene Gesserit, Mother
Gaia.
Helen Gaius. And so it's like, well, is she working for the Emperor, or does she want Paul, or what's this kind of thing? And then Jessica is asking, so let's start off at the beginning of the book, and we can, as we talk through this, I'll mention different things from the audiobook, we'll mention the English translation, the English version of the book, the German abridged translation, and the movie, and we'll talk about different things as we go through here. Just, of course, I mentioned on Twitter a few days ago, it's like, yeah, we watched the movie, we're gonna talk about that. And people say, oh, what about the miniseries? What about the computer games? I was like, yeah, we only have so much time. We're not going to do this. So it starts off, and we have these, at the beginning of all the chapters, we have the quotes from, like this says, the Manual of Mordiv by Princess Urulen. And Princess Urulen, she begins the book, and she also begins the movie as well, doesn't she? It's the planet Arrakis, we're going here. Across the world, we have these planets, and a good-looking woman comes on. And in the movie, it's really funny that when she does the introduction, it's the same introduction from the book. A beginning is the time for taking the most delicate care that the balances are correct. You know, and she starts off the movie in the same way. And she kind of fades in and out of the screen. So she's there, and then she fades out to the starfield, and then she just fades back in again. And I mentioned this to you when we were watching the movie.
Yes.
And do you know why that happens?
No.
Because the original monologue was like twice as long as that. She just reads and reads and reads. And there's, I think on YouTube, you can actually find the uncut footage of her against the starfield just talking, and she just talks and talks and talks. And for the movie release, they cut it down. And you know, there's that one cut where it suddenly cuts,
yeah,
and it goes and it cuts from a face to another face, but a bit later, and it's just like, it's like, and
yeah.
So to stop that happening time and time again, they just fade out her face, and then they cut forward a bit, and then they fade her back in again. Mm-hmm. And it's this really weird, like the whole movie is just full of compromising. There's so much being cut, and so much cut here, and then cut there, and cut here. But it starts literally in the opening shot of the movie. You understand some of the problems is that they cut so much that they even had to cut her, and they didn't have a long version and a short version of her reading. They only had the long version, and then they had to cut it. And they didn't just refilm her again, like shoot her again. So yeah, it's a very strange thing. So you get this weird fading in and out,
yeah,
of her talking. So you want to say something about Irulan at the beginning?
First of all, this is missing in the German book.
Yeah.
You don't have, like, in the English version, in the original, you have, like, before, like, at the beginning of every chapter, you have this little quote that from different books or from different, diaries or something.
Yeah.
This is not there in the German version. So, actually, at the beginning, you're not really introduced in what's going on. And this is what...
Yeah, you're kind of just thrown into it.
Yeah. Suddenly, you're in the story and... yeah, so that was a bit of a surprise when I then actually read the English book. And
but there's so much explained in those little chapter headings.
Yes. And they just cut these things.
Yeah, apparently these are all written by Princess Irulan afterwards because, of course, by the end of the book, she's brought into the circle, Interpol's circle in some way, and then and they said, oh yeah, she's got she likes writing history, so you can just write history. And so you've got the kind of feeling that all of these little quotes is from Princess Irulan, and the kind of Book of Dune itself is like a fictionalized telling of the story, like, or a, you know, like an inside view of the story, which is also outlined in the Manual of Mordib and the Life of Mordib. And
yeah, it's a little bit like a biography.
And then In My Father's House as well is another one of these books. So
yeah,
so we start on... we start on Caladan, and it starts with them packing. And Paul is a young guy. In the movie, he's pretty old. He's like 20 something, but in the book, he starts up. He's meant to be like 15 or something.
He looks older than I expected. Him to look like.
Oh, actually, it says here in a brick. He lived there for the first 15 years. So yeah, he starts off 15 years old, but in the movie, he's a lot older. But yeah, he starts there, and you get these great revelations at the beginning where you introduce not just to him, but to his family and to his father and to his mother as well. And you realize that it starts off that he is one of the long line of the House Atreides, and all of these different royal families have been controlled over, you know, thousands of years or hundreds of generations by the Bene Gesserit, and the royal families they are like the breeding ground. They're like the playground or the playthings of the Bene Gesserit. And yes, they're like, we're gonna breed a new Superman. We're gonna breed the Kwisatz Haderach, the shortening of the way. This is gonna be the next step of human evolution. And they're all training them in different ways. And they go, right, we're gonna give you a concubine. We're gonna give you a wife. And all of the these different houses, like House Harkonnen and House Carino and House Atreides, they're all like, yeah, of course, because it's really, really cool to have your own Bene Gesserit in your household, because they can tell if people are lying. They're really great warriors. They're a great bodyguard for the dukes or the barons and stuff.
Voice control power where they just by saying it in a different tone, they can make people obey.
Yeah, this is the voice. They have what's called the voice. They modulate their voice in a way, and in that way, they can command people to do stuff against their will. And I always thought of this From reading the book, I was just thought of this as the inspiration, as the Jedi mind trick. It's like, these are not the droids you're looking for. And they kind of just move on. And it's just, and in Star Wars, of course, they just do it by a little wave of the hand, you know, just to make sure that you understand that there's a Jedi mind trick thing going on here. And you go, ooh, little wave of the hand. And in the movie, which of course came out after the Star Wars movies came out as well. But they're to do their own version of the voice, which is the Jedi mind trick. But the voice came first, of course. But this whole idea was they put this really weird distortion on the voices. Yeah, so it's like, go on, you do your version.
You need to do
But it's like a croaking voice. This is the voice. So when somebody starts going, you must do this. Land this plane now, and they're like, "Oh!" But you realise that I always thought it was something more subtle, that the person didn't understand, they didn't know, that they were just felt compelled to do that thing. In the same way that if you do the Jedi mind trick on somebody, they're not compelled to do it. So the book pretty much opens with the Reverend Mother, that the head of the Bene Gesserit, coming in to test Paul, because Jessica was meant to give birth to a young girl.
Yes.
To a baby girl, and this baby girl would grow up and be mated with. Of course, this is spoiler for later on, but the idea is that she would be mated with the son of the Harkonnens, would unite the Harkonnen and Atreides bloodline, and that would be the new Superman. But she didn't want to give birth to a girl. She wanted to provide a proper heir to the.
To Leto,
to the Atreides line, because she realised that the Atreides line was going to be very, very vulnerable because it was just down to this one guy. Again, partly because of the breeding programme, partly because of the manoeuvrings of politics and all that other kind of stuff. So yes, that's why he becomes the shortening of the way, because there was meant to be another generation. And you get these different, bloodlines, you get these different hints of who could have been another Superman, who could have been the new Messiah. And you get the Count Fenring, and you get the Fayard Ruther as well from the Harkonnen side, and you realise, oh, these other guys are they're all got these. There isn't just Paul Atreides. There's these other people who are equally intelligent, equally ruthless, more ruthless or something. You know, in different ways you can like. But the Atreides have the kindness, and the Harkonnens have the hardness, and to combine them together into this perfect balance. But because Paul is born early. He's not quite balanced. He's not quite the balance that everybody was wanting. So, anything else you want to say while the very beginning? So, with this Helen Gaius coming in, you get the Gomjabar.
Yeah, and they do the Gomjabar trick thing, which in the movie was okay.
I actually quite like it in the movie.
Yeah, they did it quite okay.
Because he was looking at the Gomjabar as a box. Again, if you read Dune, you know all of this. But it's a box that you put your hand in, and it's to see if you're human, if you're human or an animal. And if you're human, you can keep control, and you can get rid of fear, and you can do the litany against fear. Was it? I will not be afraid. I will let the fear pass through me, and I'll turn my inner all that kind of stuff. If you're a real nerd, you can quote that. I'm not a real nerd. Well, I am. but that kind of the litany against fear, and the idea is if Paul pulled his hand out, he would be killed immediately by the Gomjabar.
Which is just like a needle with some poison.
Yeah.
Which he explains that it's normally given to animals.
Yeah. So this is really cool. In the book, we get introduced to the other characters as well. We get introduced to Duncan Idaho, who is the fighting master, and Thufir Hayat, who is the Mentat, isn't he, as well?
Yeah.
The Mentat being the computer-brained, the people who are trained from birth to be computer-minded, because there's no computers in this world, which is, you know, a little bit more about the world-building. And also Gurney Halleck, who is the... who is another fighting man and companion of the Duke, of Paul's father, and a musician. So we start off with this, and we really get a good human view of Paul. We get introduced to who he is, and there's this great moment in the book where he is like, say, you know, his father says to him, oh, and and you're gonna undergo training to become a mentat yourself. And he's like, no, I can't become a mentat, because if I'm a mentat, it means I'd have had to be trained and prepared since birth to become a mentat, and you're not allowed to tell them that they've been being trained since birth to become a mentat, because if you do, it means it upsets their mentat training. And then he realizes, oh,
I have been trained since birth.
Yeah, I've been trained since birth to become a mentor, but they kept it from me. And then you realize, oh, so this guy has been trained by the best fighters in the world. Like he's been trained in the ways of the Bene Gesserit by his mother, who wasn't allowed to be training
her.
Yeah, in the mental abilities and being trained in the voice and being trained in the mind control. He's been trained by Duncan Idaho as a great fighter, and Duncan Idaho and the fighting force of Gurney Halleck and these guys, they're such badasses that even the emperor is afraid of them. They're saying, wow, that the House Atreides, they're putting together a fighting force which is just way too good. They're gonna be there, like, so we gotta get rid of these guys. They're too good to have running around the galaxy doing their own things. And we get some good action later on from these guys as well. And he's been trained as a mentat to be a human computer. And he's been bred over hundreds of generations to be as cool as he is now. And you just realize, wow, this guy's... The deck is really stacked in this guy's favor. Yeah. And so it's just in this beginning part, you get like a real good introduction to all of his background and all of the different threads that are coming together into this one guy. And the best bit is that you get a view into Leto, his father, and you realize that you really want Paul to follow in the footsteps of his father, because his father is noble, his father loves his people, his father looks after his people, all of his workers are great, and of course he's got the family atomics, he's got the atomic weapons that they can fall back onto, but it's like, of course, they're always going to abide by the rule that the families can never use their atomics, and they're going to do this, and it's all about honor, and... yes, it's honor of this, and we're going to be honorful, and we're going to do this, and I'm going to remember my father. My father was a great man as well, and all the people loved him. And Paul, you're going to grow up to be the same as me, and you're going to be loved by the people and everything. And so you get the honor, the moral fortitude of his father, and you're like, yes, Paul is going to be awesome because he's got all this great stuff with him. He's going to become a big hero by the end of the book, and he's going to follow in the footsteps of his father, and he's going to be great. So we get all of that pretty much in the opening few chapters of the book.
Yes.
Except in the movie, it starts off and it's like Princess Irulan, blah, 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 blah. And then, hey, let's go over and see the Emperor. And then the Emperor sets up the whole story when the guild representative
guild comes
in.
Yeah.
And then there's the Reverend Mother is there as well. And the movie is pretty just... so did you... Because you don't really see the navigators in the book, do you?
But no,
in the movie,
you don't know what you think. It's just like people,
yeah.
Something in the movies, they have this weird monster kind of slimy,
yeah,
whatever.
This like sub Star Wars monster thing,
yeah.
With all
like it looks just like a massive head, like a massive brain with a nose, and like the nose is the same at the same time as the nose
is
the
mouth.
And,
yeah.
It's
this weird, like, you know, like the end of an elephant's trunk or something.
Yeah.
It's got this weird
talking.
Yeah, so in there they just set it all up, and it pretty much says, look, Arrakis is really important because it's called Dune. It's the only place that the spice comes from, and we're the guild, and we fly things around the known galaxy, the Empire, because we fly stuff around the Empire, we need the spice, because that's the way that we can use our minds to see through the futures, multiple futures, and bend space and transfer ships between places, and that's what they do. So they need spice, and they need the spice to be controlled. And then the Emperor is saying, well, the Harkonnens are there. And so the guild and the Emperor get together with the Harkonnens and say, what we're going to do is we're going to take the Harkonnens away, and then we're going to give the spice planet, the Dew of Dune, of Arrakis, Dune, we're going to give it to the House Atreides to look after.
Yeah.
But because House Atreides and House Harkonnen have got this, what do they call it? The Canley... some kind of long-running feud between the two of them, and it's an official one. So they can declare war and fight each other with no problem. So all we need to do is give the planet of Dune to the Atreides, and then because the Atreides and the Harkonnens are these long-running enemies anyway, we'll just let the Harkonnens then take over Dune again, wipe out the Atreides fighting force, wipe out the House of Atreides, and they'll just be all good, and it'll all be fine like that. And just make sure that the Harkonnens, because the Harkonnens could never knock out the Atreides, they would never be able to defeat the Atreides by themselves. So we'll give them our Sardaukar, we'll give them our own imperial fighting force of our own to help them out with this. And they're like, yep, that's good. Yep, let's go it. Let's do it. And of course, the Reverend Mother, the Bene Gesserit, they don't know about this, or they're suspecting it's going to be happening and things, but they can't interfere with it too much. And they're, even though they're warning, oh yeah, it's going to be this. So what happens is that's what happens, really, isn't it?
In the movie. In the movie. Book, it's different.
Yeah, you don't get to know all of that like straight away. It's not laid out quite that clearly.
You always have when, like at the beginning, when Paul has this conversation with his father and with Gurney Halleck, when they talk about it. I mean, he's quite introduced in that trap because the Atreides know.
They know there's treachery going on. Yeah,
and also you soon realize that there's a traitor under them.
Yes.
To have somebody who wants to kill somebody in the Atreides. But like in the book, it's really well done because you have these characters and you have a conversation of the characters. And then suddenly it is switching to the thoughts of one of the characters.
Yeah.
And then you get something to know about the thoughts of one of the characters, and then suddenly it switches back to the other character in the
and you get to know their thoughts as well.
That's really well done.
So in the way in most books you get, it's either told from one point of view, from the point of view of like one person, or it's told from different points of view, but it's like, okay, you get one chapter told from one point of view and then another chapter told from another point of view, and here it's every paragraph or every sentence almost. I guess it's whenever there's a paragraph change, you could be in somebody else's head.
Exactly.
So you skip from one to the other. So there's never any secrets. It's like, and now we're talking to the Harkonnens. And the Harkonnens are going, yes, well, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do. And then you skip to the other one and you go, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do. And then even when you're going, oh, there's a traitor. Who is the traitor? And then you just skip to someone's head and it's like, I'm the traitor. So there's no secrets. I mean, this is one of the things which so many books can... I mean, it's just so easy to do this so wrong. I mean, it's just so easy to... And I've read and reviewed, if you've been a long-term listener of this, one of my main complaints about so many books is that it's like, well, is this person just not curious? Like, the only reason why we don't know about it is because that person just can't be bothered to ask about the problem, or, you know, there's something happening. It's like, why didn't you, like... If you really are the daughter of a queen, why are you waiting until the book begins to actually then look up what is going on here? And there's other books which you actually read. I can remember one was called Crystal Rain by Tobias S. Bakel, and it's just like, hey, you want to know this about your father? Yes, please. Okay, let me tell you the backstory of your father. He did this and did this and did this and did this. Oh, that's enough for this chapter. I'll tell you the rest later. And you're just like, tell me it now. And the reason why he doesn't tell you it straight away is because that's the only way to keep that dramatic tension of like, why, like that, to keep any kind of mystery in the book, is for a character to literally say, I know this. I could tell you all of this, but I'm not going to.
Yes.
For no reason except I'm not going to tell you it now.
Yeah. And I mean, in this book, everything is laid out all the time. Like, the reader always knows what, like, weird plans people have and what's going on in Paul's head, for example. This is really, later on when he has this conflict in himself about his father, and he can't mourn about him.
Yeah.
And he knows, oh, I'm probably the Kwisatz Haderach.
Kwisatz Haderach,
and all that stuff. And
you spend a long time in Paul's head sometimes. Yes. A bit too much time in Paul's head.
A bit too much. Like, yeah. And then, you read all that and you think, oh, well, yeah.
But I understand what one of the main problems of the movie is, that how do you do this? It's a movie where everybody knows, and I think that's why they started off with the upfront, okay, meeting between the navigators, the guild navigators, and the emperor, and this, we're just going to lay it all out now in advance.
Yes.
And so then when they got to it, I mean, it's just a terrible movie. Terrible movie, because they just cut so much out. There's so much good stuff in there. I mean, there's so much, like, good set design at the beginning. You're like, wow, I wish they'd have spent more money on the script and the story and the special effects than all the
set design. It feels a bit like the German abridged version.
Yes, exactly. They cut out so many of these. Okay, we need to know what's in everybody's head. And then the worst thing about the movie is that they have these voiceovers. And because in the book, let me put it this way, Frank Herbert in the book, he is not afraid to go into anybody's head and talk about anybody from inside anybody's head. And that's great in a book. Once you get used to when you're reading the book, once you get used to it. In a movie, it's really, really distracting when suddenly it goes, blah, 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 and people are talking, blah, 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 and suddenly it goes into this, like, echoey voice. Oh, and this, surely, is the question. This is what the legends say, or this is what the, you know, and it just goes into, it's like, wait a second, this guy's only spoken three words or three lines up until now, and then you know what's going on inside his head, so this really weird flicking around between people's heads is a bit strange. And also the worst thing about the movie is that it starts off and you don't care about Paul as a person. When you finally do get in there, you see him, you know, coming in and he has a fight and then he has a fight against a robot, but you don't get any of that, you know, that close personal attention that you get in the beginning of the book, you spend way, way more time with the Baron Harkonnen and the Beast Raban and Fayed Ruther, his two heirs.
Sting plays that.
But I actually really like the bad guys. Some of the way these characters look. Paul Atreides is totally different in my head, but the Baron Harkonnen is great because he's so fat that he's got these suspensor belt, these suspensor fields around him, so he floats around, and I think that's very effective in the movie. It's very effective, and that kind of, like, once you understand what's going on there and then you read the book, you're like, oh, okay, yeah, I get this kind of point. Sting as Fayed Ruther, I mean, yeah, it's pretty good.
Well, yeah,
he's all, like, in his underpants and stuff, and of course Duncan Idaho and Gurney Halleck as Captain Picard as Gurney Halleck, you know. Now after watching that movie, I mean, I watched the movie years ago, I'd already read the book, and then I watched the movie, and I've read the book many times since then. And for me now, Captain Picard is Gurney Halleck, and that's just the way that I look at it. And also, I liked in the movie to notate, so you know what a Mentat looks like. It's like, yes, they have red stained lips. Now, I can't remember if that's in the book or not, but it's a good way to visually represent, this person is a Mentat, and when the Harkonnen Mentat dies, it's like, yes, they need another Mentat, so they bring on the other guy, which in the movie is just kind of skipped over, but it's a massive part of the book, how the Harkonnens turn people against the Atreides, and they do it with, like, three different people, I can remember.
What I really disliked about the movie was, in fact, that, like, the time when Paul and his mother spend...
Let's get to that. Let's move on to that. Let's do that a bit more chronologically. So, moving on. Okay. Should we get to that? So what happens is the Atreides come down, land on the planet, the Harkonnens leave, and of course the Harkonnens have left lots of traps around there.
And spies.
And there's some good bits and pieces in the book where, you know, they find a... There's in Paul's bed that a little thing comes out and flies around.
Yeah, the little robot, which is like radio controlled or something.
Yeah,
like,
and someone is down in the cellar. Yeah. He's been bricked up in the cellar. Some Harkonnen is bricked up in the cellar. Yeah.
It's like another trap thing.
and they explore the house and they do this bits and pieces. And this first half of the book is pretty much setting up what this main... this main conflict is going to be, that all the time you're waiting, okay, the Harkonnens are going to come back. Yeah. We know it's a big trap. The whole of Arrakis, the whole of the planet is a big trap.
Yeah.
And you're just waiting for the Harkonnens to get back, to come back in. And most of this is cut out of the book.
Out of the movie, and the movie as well.
Yeah.
And what is not cut out in the German book is the scene where Jessica is in that plant house.
Yeah, in the greenhouse.
In the greenhouse thing. And she finds this message of Lady Fenring.
Yes.
And so when you actually get to know all these characters and you realise, oh, what is Lady Fenring? Is she good guy or bad guy? Like, is she for Atreides or against them? And what about her
And it
husband?
Turns out she's not. She's for the Bene Gesserit.
Yeah, exactly. So it's always this funny kind of who is in which faction, what is the alliance, and who's good guy, bad guy. And they cut that totally out of the movie.
Yeah.
That doesn't appear anywhere there.
Now, talking about the Fenrings, one thing I really like in the book is Count Fenring, who is a eunuch, isn't he? He's got no dangly bits, or no functional dangly bits.
Yeah, true.
And the idea being that he is one of these, he could have been one of the fathers of... one of the fathers of the Krisus Haderach, one of the fathers of these Superman, the Übermensch. And so you're thinking, okay, well, he's there, but then what's he doing? And the great scenes in the book where his wife is saying, oh, the Bene Gesserit told me that I've got to go and seduce this guy over here. And he's like, oh, okay, that's okay. And in the audiobook version that I had, it's a very strange audiobook narration that I got from Audible, is that parts of it is narrated just by one person who is a really good narrator. I forgot to look up his name. And then parts of it is like as a full cast style audio where lots of different people are saying the lines of the characters, but it switches back between them. So sometimes it's one guy doing all of the voices and sometimes they have actors doing them and doing the same voices, and you'd think that that'd be really confusing, but to be honest, even within the same chapter, it starts off and there's a full cast and then it just switches over to one guy doing all the reading, and I didn't notice it. And now I understand why this is because they obviously did a full cast recording of an abridged version of it, and then he did the rest.
Yeah.
So Count Fenring was cut out of the abridged version of it. And then when he filled in all the other non-abridged bits, he's doing all the Count Fenring voices, and his Count Fenring voice is really great. It's like, you know, in the Fenring, like, he's this slimy character, and he's like, I think I'm, well, you know, I think about him,
Actually, that works pretty well when it's an audiobook, but when you actually read it, it's terrible to read, because, like, you have the sentence, and the sentence is, like, half of, and then in between you have little words, and you have to collect the words together to make yourself clear what does he want to say. Mm. So that's a bit distracting in the book.
Yeah.
But I can imagine that it's really nice in an audiobook. And also, you have the songs by Gerne Hellick, is it?
Yes.
Him singing, where you have, like... sometimes a whole page
with text.
Like just text, like a poem kind of, which is not really a poem. So and it's terrible to read. I don't like reading song lyrics. It just doesn't make sense.
Mm.
And so that's always
in the book. They do in the audiobook narration. The melodies are not always great, but they do have some singing going on there, even if it's not really
that actually
really clear.
Works.
Could you just lean down and turn the heater off, because it's like we're talking here. And and another thing that is cut out of the movie completely is all the idea of the music, because you get, like, Gurney Halleck comes in and he's got this massive great balisette thing.
Yeah.
And I always imagine that to be like a little ukulele sized thing.
Yeah.
So when he's going into battle, he can just
portable.
Have it on his back.
Yeah, yeah.
And it doesn't really get in the way, and it's just like his calling card. And then Captain Picard walks in with it, and this massive thing, and he takes it over and puts it over in the corner, like that, and puts it down, and guess what? Never touches it again. Never see it again for the rest of the movie. And you realise that, of course, I think they filmed enough for like a 6 hours worth of footage or something for that movie, and the idea being that they could have made it into like a mini-series, like a Dune mini-series, because this book is just so, so huge.
So much in it.
So much in it, yeah. And there's another thing that I was going to talk a bit more about, was that there's this meeting... this meeting that we mentioned beforehand with this conference around this this banquet. And like I say, this is where you really see the tension getting to the Duke Leto Atreides, and you see his son is there and like backing him up, and you realize, oh, Paul is going to be a really good leader somewhere. And you see Jessica looking at her son and going, oh man, this my kid is going to be awesome. I did the right thing providing an heir for the Duke, so his, you know, his bloodline will continue, so it's not just, you know, he won't, if the idea being that if she had given birth to a daughter, and only a daughter, it would have been meant that would have been the end of House Atreides, because she'd have been married off into some other house. And kind of the House Atreides would disappear at that point, I guess, or be subsumed into another thing. into another house, and then you get like the water trader who's looking at this, and then the water trader's daughter, and you get
the smuggler.
Yeah, you get the smuggler. The spice smuggler. You get the spice trader.
And you get the ecologist Keynes.
Yeah, the Keynes or Kynes, as they called him in the movie. in the German movie Kynes, which that makes sense because it's a Keynes Kynes is probably the more of a German way of saying that name. Yeah. And you get him, and you just get, and it really sets up. It's just like, yes, this is a desert planet. There is no water here. Off of Dune, spice is the most important thing. On Dune, spice isn't the most important thing. Water is the most important thing, and everybody knows that everything comes back to water and spice in this book. A great kind of analogies to oil and energy, and I love books which do this. They recast kind of Earth politics or Earth like economics or economies and all this other kind of stuff into a new way. There's a really great book. Did you listen to the audiobook of the Alchemist and the Executionist?
No,
did you listen to that? But that's a really great one with every time someone uses magic, a bit more weed grows. And the idea, I mean, the way that I reviewed this book, and because I reviewed it almost immediately after it came out, there was no other reviews to read of it. But the way that I did it is like, yes, using up magic becomes a finite resource, which fucks over the world in the same way that using energy is a finite resource, you know, a burning fuel is finite, which fucks up the earth in that way. And I really love this, that Dune was doing this, you know, back in the 1960s and getting everything right, you know, and all of these different ways of, you know, proxy wars to control things, and, you know, and taking out dictators to control it, you know, all of the Middle East politics. It's like, oh, you read Dune, and then it's like, oh, it's suddenly all become clear, yeah. You know, because that's what he's writing about. You know, he's pretty much writing about Middle East politics, even to the point of, you know, religious wars over holy territories.
And so,
yeah, the jihad against this and this against that, and the Messiah's here, and Holy Land, and the different prophets. And Keynes is definitely very much a John the Baptist figure for the Messiah of Jesus. He's the voice in the wilderness calling out and leading the people. And all this really great stuff there. What else was I going to say about that?
It's after the dinner. After the big dinner, it's like...
What I was going to say is that before then, they go out and you go out into the desert. So you have a bit of a trip out in there.
It's the first trip out in the desert and everything is introduced.
Now, in the German book, this whole amazing setup bit where it sets up all of the characters that you need, all of the politics, everything that you need to know about Dune is all set up in this one conference, and you see all of it, and it's a great look into all of these different minds, and it goes on for like a full chapter of just this one conversation which goes around, and they're playing off each other, and that's all missing.
Missing. Yeah. And I'm really, it's always like, when I think, like, who decides what
gets cut?
What gets cut? I mean, for some people that might not be a main part, but in fact, it is really a major part.
It really is a main part. So, and this is where you said, oh man, it really kicked off really quickly. Everything happened really quick.
But not only that, after I've read the English version, I read all the, like they had the dinner and all that. But still, that was quite an abrupt, like when they actually started, Conan started, and like the traitor did his thing and all that. And suddenly, can I say that Leto dies?
Yes, this is spoiler.
Really abrupt,
this is a spoiler edition.
Really abrupt, and suddenly he's dead. And Jessica, Paul's mother, and Paul, they have to fight their way through, and then they are in the desert.
Yeah,
and that's it. That was all the story about that.
Yeah,
what happened.
Shit goes
nice,
down
like, in a nice noble house of. Really important, powerful people.
Yeah.
Suddenly they are nothing.
Yeah. But the point is, it happened so quickly because they didn't know that the Emperor was going to lend his shock troops, Sardaukar troops, to the Harkonnens, because the Harkonnens would never have been able to take over that quickly. And they thought, oh, well, you know, we've got in the shield wall around Arakeen, we've got our troops up there, and they're here and there, and we'll all be fine.
Yeah.
And then they just come boom down. And as long as there's no survivors who saw the Sardaukar fighting with Harkonnen,
Harkonnen's
like that.
Uniforms,
and it turns out there are some survivors. Yes, Jessica and Paul get away because...
And also, Duncan Idaho...
Dies.
No, first he's still there.
Yeah.
He dies a bit later. And then you have Halleck and Howard. I always mix them up.
Yeah,
I
Howard never... and Halleck. Gurney Halleck and Howard Thufir, or whatever his name is.
Thufir, Halleck. Howard
Thufir.
No, it's...
Gurney Halleck.
Howard is the last name, so it's Thufir, Halleck, Howard.
Halleck, Gurney. No, it's Gurney Halleck.
Gurney Halleck and Thufir Howard.
Oh, is it? I always thought it was Howard Thufir. Okay. No,
why, because both of names start with a H, and so...
Yes,
I always,
okay, it gets confusing.
Terrible mix. And so all of these, like, important characters first make it through.
Yeah.
And then some points they all, like, get kicked out. Like, first it's Idaho, and then it's Keynes. And
they all disappear out into the desert.
Oh, and the other two guys, Halleck and Howard, they disappear to the Harkonnens and...
No, Halleck goes and joins the smugglers, the spice smugglers, and Howard thinks that Jessica was the traitor, and then goes to work because
he has to.
Put it this way, Huey, the doctor, says, I am betraying House Atreides, but I'm also betraying House Harkonnen.
Yeah.
So he wants to, in one fell swoop, in one poison tooth spray, kill both Duke Leto,
like,
and
both enemies,
and Harkonnen. Yeah,
yeah.
So, but he wants Paul to survive because he doesn't actually want to destroy the house. He's just to kill Harkonnen, I'm gonna have to sacrifice Duke Atreides, Leto. But that's fine because Paul will still be around and he'll look after everything. That'd be good. Yeah.
So and then when they are in the desert,
there
is this long...
Oh, then it takes a long time. Yeah.
Long scene where they fight themselves through, and then they lose the little package and they get it back, and then they
oh yeah, they get sucked into sand and then back out of sand, and then
it's like, and this part is just so long, and it's just not...
But it's doing so much as well.
But also, like, you have these massive long monologues in their heads.
Yes.
And these monologues are really... Yeah, I really didn't like it. So when you have the Lady Jessica, and you have a certain view on the characters, you have the view on the mother, and you have the view on the boy who is 15 years old, so is still a boy, and she's the mother. And at this point, suddenly it switches. Then you have the weak, like Jessica gets weak.
Yeah, because she's in
Paul,
grief. She's like... With her husband has just died and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that's the point, is because Paul, his breeding and training is taking over, and he's denying his human side and like by not grieving his father. And Jessica is embracing her human side by grieving
But
Paul's
like
father.
What I always expect then at this point is Jessica to go to her son and just like embrace him, or like give some humanity, like say, hey, you, it's okay, you can just mourn and everything's fine. And like she in this point she loses her motherhood towards Paul, and I didn't like that. It's just like, well, why did he do that? And like in this really long scene where they're like intense.
Oh, it just goes on for ages. I know that. I think that's the one point that where you just goes backwards and forwards, but in their two heads. And I think there could have been a different way of doing that. Now, what happens next is that Paul goes and joins up with the Fremen. And I really love it in the book. It's one of all my favourite scenes are in the book. Well, not all my favourite scenes, but another lot of my favourite memorable scenes are in this section of the book where Paul goes and he meets them and they're like, oh, we should be able to take them. It's just these two people. And because Paul has been trained by Duncan Idaho and his mother is a Bene Gesserit, who's also been training Paul, and they're like kicking ass with these guys, and you realise that if they really wanted to, they could just by overwhelming numbers kill Paul and Jessica, but they realise there's something more to them. They're like, wow, who are these guys? And
of course Keynes, who is like the lead, like the god kind of...
Well, he's a prophet, he's the John the Baptist
prophet,
kind of thing.
But because he told them, oh, there are these two people coming.
Yeah, look out for them, yeah.
Take care of them.
Yeah.
And so they kind of realize, oh, this must be the two he told us about.
Yeah.
And then also, this is the big scene that was cut out.
Yeah, that's what I wanted
to
say. Like, so what happens, of course, if you read the book, and this is a massive spoiler, so Paul meets up with these people, and the crucial, it's like there's these two really crucial parts. One of them is that he meets Keynes' daughter Shani, who's half Fremen, half not human. Fremen, half human. No, Fremen are human as well.
No, I mean, like,
don't be racist. But yeah, she's there, and they meet up, and you realize that something, a little bit of oh, nods. Oh yeah, you're pretty cool like that. And they kind of meet each other. Oh, just and they're kind of tucked together. And he's like, and then they. We'll talk about it in a second why he gets it, but he gets some water and he gets these water tokens and he's like, oh, what do I do with those? Could you look after these for me? And it's a great moment. And when she's like, are you really? You want me to? He's like, yeah, what's the problem? She was like, okay, I'll tell you.
Okay, and then if you give your water to a woman, it means like, now you're engaged.
Yeah, now we're engaged to be married. It happens by accident. But it's all of these, all at this point, there's all of these different steps, which is. Again, it's this weird thing. It's like, how much of this is a prophecy that was really set up in place millennia before? Mm. I mean, is this really a prophecy and all of these bits of prophecy are falling into place because of some weird fate? It's like, is fate a real thing, or is it because of breeding, like, that they bred it? And you get all these great hints that, you know, generations before the Bene Gesserit, they've been going down, like, seeding these weird cargo cult-like religion
everywhere,
things
all
like
over
this.
The
all
universe.
Over the place. It's like, everywhere we go, we're in it for the long run. We're going to be around for 1,000 years. So we're going to make sure that if we land on a planet, in 1,000 years' time, we have this special gnosis. We have the knowledge. We have the key phrases. Yeah. We know the secrets of all of the religions
so,
that are there.
Like, what happened is that on Arrakis, there was a Bene Gesserit before. And so she introduced these kind of phrases and important sentences and stuff. And then when
different
Jessica,
code words,
and then when Jessica comes there and they ask her like it's like this weird, what am I supposed to say? What am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
And then she knows of all that because she realized, oh, there was a Bene Gesserit and now I can use this word because that fits here.
And then you've got the whole idea of, well, how much was this like and how much is it? It's like, well, they gave him all these water tokens, but they're all these little things, and he doesn't know what to do with them. And like, by giving her, like, by putting Shani next to it, isn't it the what's the guy's name? The main Fremen guy, the Stilgar.
Stilgar.
So it's like, how much of him putting Paul together with Shani and saying, you look after him, because he knows what Paul is going to do when he gets these bits. It's like, well, what do I do with them? You know, and it's like, well, how much is it fate and how much is it all setting up there? Yes. You know, and like the way that he chooses his name. What are you going to be called? I'll be called Mordib, what's the mouse in the moon? Oh, Mordib. And it's like, oh, Mordib, that was going to be the name of our Messiah. Oh, this is all prophecy. And yet, all the time you think, it was like, how much is this prophecy? How much is it the Bene Gesserit putting stuff in place?
How much is this Paul seeing
into the future? So there isn't a prophecy, but he, because he, you know, he's got all of this, you know, he's been bred to be like a mentat, so he can calculate all of this. He's got massive amounts of spice in his blood now from living there, so he's got the same kind of prescient, like, looking in down these future lines that the navigators have got. Yeah. He's got the Bene Gesserit training, and he's got his own, you know, political scheming, political self, and it's all been set up in this fight. And you're always thinking, well, how much of this is how much of it's fate? Yeah. How much of it is manipulated prophecy? How much of it is just being able to see in the future, either in the supernatural spice kind of way or in the natural scheming political kind of way? And that's what I really love about it. It's always a little bit ambiguous. It's like, how many of these different factors are playing in? And you realize, oh, all of them. Because in every single step of this book, every time you think, oh, well, how many factions are involved in this, on this one page? You read any page of the book and you're like, how many factions are involved in, like, the events on this one page? Or, depending on how this turns out, how many factions would be, how would it be affected? And you realize all of them. And every single page, you just go, wow, this is way more complicated than I thought. Yeah. And then you turn the next page and you go,
and
oh man,
more
it's more
and more complicated.
More and more complicated. And I think that's why you don't need to have any secrecy in the book. Everything is so complex that it doesn't matter how much information that you know, You still don't know.
You're still confused.
Yeah, you still don't know what's going to happen. And even the characters there, it doesn't matter how much they know. Even if they know everything, Paul is going, yeah, I know everything now. How much can I change the future? Or what is going to happen in the future? What can I do? And this is one of the key things in this book, is that everything is really complicated, which means that every single time you read it, every time you read it through again, you go, oh, that means this. You know, and that was the first time when you... You know, when I read it through, I'd read it like 3-4 times. And I think it was just in the narration, like the audiobook narration that they do. And then Paul's water tokens get given to Shani. And you're just like, still got to set that up. You know, and it's just one of those things. And you're like, oh, did he? And then you're thinking, well, maybe he did. Or is it just like a romantic comedy? Was it the meet cute? You know, they're like, it's really cute. And it is really cute and good. And the other thing that happens at that stage of the book is that Paul gets into a fight by... What was the other guy's
Jamis?
Name?
Jamis.
Jamis. I always thought Jamis. This upstart guy everybody knows that he's going to be the next guy to challenge Stilgar, because he's the new... He's going to take over. But Stilgar is still a badass, and, you know, he has to be beaten in battle for Jamis to become the next one in line. And Jamis challenges Paul Atreides, and all of the Fremen think, oh man, Paul is going to die so quickly.
I mean, they all think of him as a boy.
Yeah, because he's 15 years old.
He's a child there.
Yeah.
And Jamie's is like, maybe like 20.
Yeah, he's already married and got 2 kids or 3 kids, hasn't he?
Yeah, so, and he's a strong, big guy. And you think, oh wow, now he will die.
Yeah, and everyone thinks that. And Jessica is like, Paul, be careful. And Paul is like, I've probably got this. And it turns out, yeah, Paul's got this. And but because Paul is so used to fighting with a shield, where if you stab hard, it deflects it. So if you move your knife really slowly in the killing blow, it gets through.
It gets through the other one's blade.
And that's how Paul has been trained to fight. So when he's fighting, all of the time, at the last moment, he slows his knife down as though the other guy is wearing a shield. And I really love this scene in the book, because everybody else think he's playing with Jamis, and everyone is like, oh man, you're being a real dick about this, Paul. And and of course he kills Jamis, and then the key moment in the entire book, the turning point of the entire book, of the entire story, and we set this up at the beginning, is that you're thinking, oh, Paul is going to be great because he's going to follow in his father's footsteps, and we're going to become
really a sympathetic character.
You're like, you're always on his side. And there's this one point, and the other people think he's toying with Jamis. Oh, Jamis. It's called him Jamis. Everyone thinks he's toying with Jamis, except him. And then he realizes that everybody is thinking he's toying. It's like, oh, I've got to end this quick. And there's no way for him to end it without either him or Jamis dying.
Yeah.
So he kills Jamis. And he's like, right, I'm powerful and that kind of stuff. And there's this really key line in the entire book where Jessica goes, I have got to say something now. This is it, because this is the first person Paul has ever killed.
Yeah.
And Jessica goes, I have got to say something now to make Paul feel bad about killing somebody.
Yeah.
I've got to make him so he follows in the footsteps of his father, who is always concerned about every single person. He's going to be honorable. He's never going to kill anybody. He's never going to harm anybody. He's going to be, you know, he's going to have like all of these symbols around him. He's going to have all of these thoughts and all these ways of thinking about the world, and he's going to care for everyone, because that being loved is the most important thing, because everyone loved, like, Duncan Idaho, Gurney Halleck, all these guys loved Paul Atreides so much that they would never turn on him, and that's what he needs. He needs to make people love him, and he needs to... So he's like, I've got to say a word, I've got to say something which will make sure Paul understands all of this.
Yeah.
And so she delivers her line, and it cuts Paul hard.
Yeah.
But guess what? Not hard enough.
Yeah, unfortunately.
and then the story continues, and what you have there is what are you looking for now? Are you looking?
I tried to find the phrase, but I probably don't. Find
I'm not sure exactly. It's quite a long way in. Look, Fremen's. Yeah, it's just before this part. Jamis. Here it is. Oh, no, this is when they're doing the Water of Jamis as well. So, yeah, if you skip back a bit. So, anyway, at this point, you look for that, and I'll keep talking a bit. So, at this point, you realise that if Paul becomes too much like a Fremen, and another massive spoiler here, at this point they've worked out that Paul is actually Baron Harkonnen's grandson, because Jessica is the daughter of of Baron Harkonnen. So is he going to follow in the footsteps of the Harkonnens, or is he going to follow in the footsteps of the Atreides? And this is where it turns. And from everything, and this is what we've been reading more recently, and you see it in the movie. Actually, all of this is left out of the movie. The most important section of the book, yeah. Which is Paul being introduced to the Fremen. What's it? What she says here?
No, I just had it.
Oh, you had it a second ago. Where are you looking for?
It was just there.
No, it's here. It's here, what she thinks here. That's what I've just been saying. He's gonna.
That's funny.
It doesn't matter. Anyway, so yeah, Jessica says something and it doesn't, and then you realise, Paul, he's got two courses of everywhere of this ahead of him, and then towards the rest of the book, you thought at the beginning of the book this was going to be about a hero. This is going to be about the rise of a hero. And then what happens? It's actually about the rise of a tyrant. It's the rise of a dictator who has got all of the skills and all of the powers that come with the Atreides training and the Bene Gesserit and all that kind of stuff. And then you're not going to find it. You obviously hit the bottom. This is the point about looking through ebooks. It's difficult. Sometimes a bit more difficult to flick through it. Okay, forget it. Okay. You're distracting me now. Anyway, all of this was left out of the movie. So the movie tells a story of a guy who's really nice at the beginning, who goes through and gets all this training, and then he goes over to the Fremen, and then almost immediately, Shani, with none of the water tokens or all that, it's like, let's get married. Yeah. I love you
and
so much.
They just kiss them.
And without any fighting of Jamis, he doesn't earn his way into the tribe at all. He's just like, your new name will be this. It's like, he has to earn his name. Why didn't he earn his name? Yeah. All of that's left out. And then he's the one who starts training all the Fremen instead of them training him in the ways of desert and moving around, because it's desert control. That's all he was talking about. And the idea of it being, you know, the idea of the water tyranny, where if you control people's water, and this is what they did in ancient Egypt, ancient Egypt survived so long, is that they were just like, all of these peasants and all these farmers and all these people live over there. What we'll do, we'll just cut off the water supply, wait for them all to starve, wait for them all to die.
And then they
stop doing it, or they all just die out. We'll just kill them off. And then we'll put new people, new farmers over in the land, give them water again. The land is all good again. And so the whole idea of the water tyranny, it's not tyranny. What's the... There's a different word for it, but water tyranny is what you need to do, and it's the same kind of thing which happens around the world. And he's like, no, we need desert power. And then again, the same way that the British Empire is like, yes, we're going to have the sea power. We're going to be our navy is going to be bigger than any other two navies combined.
At this point, he develops the idea of, when I am able to destroy the spice,
yes,
I can control everything.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like, if I can stop the spice getting off Arrakis, I can control the empire. Yeah. I can control the Bene Gesserit because they need it. Yeah. I can control the what's the other things he needs? He needs the and the guild as well. So he can control the guild. And the other great thing is that you get this great scene when it's kind of reported off the page, off the screen, is where the Harkonnens, they think, we're okay giving Arrakis over to the Atreides because we've got our stockpile over here. And in the end, it's like, we're fine if, you know, all this weird stuff is going down because we got our stockpile. And Paul sends the guys over on a suicide mission to take out the Harkonnen stockpile. And then they're like, get you next time, Harkonnen, you're Atreides. And there's this great scene. There's these great scenes where the Baron Harkonnen is like, fuck it, bring me a small boy virgin to kill because that's what I need. Yeah, so... There's these great things that Paul is in the end he's doing his water tyranny, he's doing his desert power, all of these different ways of political control, which is so much more interesting than most science fiction and most fantasy books, where it's like, we'll just send these people over there and they'll fight our way through to victory. And Paul is a lot cleverer than that. The atomics is you're never allowed to use atomic weapons on anybody else or any other humans, but he's like, I won't use them on this. I'll use them on the shield wall and knock that out, and then we'll ride the storm. The storm will go through and knock out the Harkonnens, the Emperor's stuff, and then the worms will come through and they'll be attracted to the shields and wipe this stuff out. And again, when you get to the end of it, it's the same kind of thing. It's a mirror of when the Harkonnens come in and knock out the Atreides. And you're like, wow, it really goes quick at the end. That's another thing, isn't it?
Yeah, the actual fight at the end is quite sudden. Yes. And like, quite quick and short.
But the whole 600 pages of the book before then is setting up everything, all of the elements that you need. The family atomics, the sandstorms, you've heard about them, the worms, the Fremen, the shields, the atomic-like thing where
the
distill suits. Again, all of this stuff which we haven't talked about in the last hour and a quarter that we've been talking here. But there's all of this kind of stuff, and it all leads up to... Oh, and as you were talking through, you were reading it, and you were like, wow, this is written... No, what was the thing that you just pointed out today, where Paul points to... Oh, no, that was in the movie. Let me say in the movie, where he says when they knock out the... They knock out a... the Ornithopters or the Harkonnens thing, and they say, oh, well, at least we managed to save the spice machine. And Gurney says, well, your father would have been more concerned about the men. And you get these, and you realise that, like, when Paul is, like, going, kill all of these guys. Oh, there's Gurney Halleck. No, don't kill Gurney Halleck. What about the other guys? Should we kill the other guys? And Gurney says, oh, don't kill all these other guys. It's like, well, they're on our territory. It's like, well, they're going to die anyway. Ah, they should know how to get... And you realise that Paul is becoming more and more callous towards humans and more and more discaring.
And I think this is also this kind of... artificial fate thing they created, because they he's becoming more a bit of a mix between the House of Atreides and Harkonnens.
Yeah.
So he's becoming not a complete Atreides and not complete becoming a complete Harkonnen, because he's still a bit like on his father's, and then
he's still got a bit of that honor, and he's still got a bit of that. But then, still, right at the end,
this is what
you pointed out to me, is sort of like they point out Princess Uraland. What do you say? So, tell me about that.
Yeah. He says something. Let me find the sentence. It's just right at the end.
So at the end, they go in, and the Emperor's on the traders, and the Bene Gesserit on traders, and I think it's right there at the very end, like page 600 and something, 615 or something. So they get all the, you get the end, and all of the different players there. The Harkonnens are there, the traders are there, the Emperor is there, like all the board game characters that we've seen there. We've got the Fremen there, and the guild, or the Spacer Guild there and stuff. So everyone's there, and Paul is just sort of like riding roughshod over all of these things. And then he looks over and he sees the Emperor, and with the Emperor is with Princess Uraland. You're not going to find it again, are you?
It's earlier on.
Oh, is it?
I find it. Yeah.
Yeah.
He is he talks to Jessica in there, and he says, aside to his mother, he said, that's Uraland, the oldest, isn't it?
Yeah.
So he talks about this princess, this human, as it.
Well, but again, it's a bit ambiguous. It's like, that's Uraland. So that is Uraland, the oldest, isn't it? But isn't she? And you realise at this point he's become totally desensitised to any kind of human of anything, that he's fine about it. And then I think even the fight with the final Harkonnen heir. That was missing from the German version, but then it ends up with a fight once the Baron is knocked out, and it's just Fade Ruther, played by Sting in the movie. And then they have this fight between the two of them. So it comes down to, once again, man on man, me against it. And this is Paul's last casting, because he knows all to the future. And he's like, this is the last thing I can possibly do to retain my humanity. And the only way to retain my humanity and not lose control over the future, and to stop this massive jihad that he sees of him becoming this tyrant, he says, the last thing that can stop me is the person who is more evil than me, which is the Harkonnen at that point. And he's like, I will leave it up to chance, I will leave it up to fate now. I don't know, it's like a flip of a coin, which way is it going to go? And in a way, you're thinking, ah, oh, this if he dies, that's going to be way better for the entire, you know, like for everybody in a way. And it's really weird that by the end of the book, you actually got to the point where, like, the first time I read the book, I didn't really understand all the subtlety of this. And I was looking at much more of a hero's journey. And I was like, yes, of course he's going to win. And he's going to bring peace to the world. And he's going to do this and do that. And then he wins. And it's like, yay. And then you realize it's a lot more complex. It's a bit more like, if you think about the end of... at the end of Star Wars, where you know, Luke, at the beginning of the book, you think this is going to be a hero's journey, and at the end he's going to kill Darth Vader and it's going to be great and everyone's going to be happy, and then at the end you're like, no, don't kill Darth Vader. And it's way more common, and you realize, oh, it was a totally different journey than you thought it would be. And at the end of this, like, now when I read it, I'm like, oh man, what would happen if Feyd Ruther, who is, like, he's the bad guy, of course, but he's not gonna be as bad as Beast Rabban. They're gonna have some the Count Fenring's Countess Fenring's daughter is they're gonna be able to, marry her to Fenring, and they're gonna have like a new Qizzis Haderach, who isn't a shortening of the way, who is just the new next step, and then they'll be happy.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Princess Irulan can, you know, and all of these different things. You're like, oh, this could go there. And it's like, oh, they could have actually, like, had a peaceful progression onto the next step of human evolution. And you're like, yeah, it'd probably be best if Feyd Ruther wins at this point, because we got rid of the Baron Harkonnen.
Yeah.
Everything's set up, you know. The Fremen will be fine, you know, everyone's in charge, Gurney Halleck will take over and this, you know, and that kind of thing. And you'll have Aaliyah as well, and she can do, and then you're just like, yay, Paul should die, and then he doesn't, and you're like, yay, like the naive read, or the first few times you read this book, you're like, yay, Paul win, he's now the emperor. And then you read the next book, Dune Messiah, and you're like, oh fuck, Paul's a Paul. Like, again, I don't want to get into the prequels and sequels and stuff, but the sequel is pretty much, Paul, he's been in charge for for 15 years now, and he's killed billions of people across the galaxy. He's putting stuff in these other, you know, and you just read it and go, wow, he's building massive temples to himself. The biggest palaces that have ever been created are being created there. And you realize he's setting up this 1,000-year dynasty of his offspring. And and then, of course, you get Children of Dune, and then God Emperor of Dune. And you're like, oh, that's what Paul was really going towards, being, of course, it's his son who goes on to be the new Leto. Who becomes the God Emperor of Dune. Or is it the grandson? Oh, I can't remember. Anyway, so it's this weird setup that you think it's going in one direction. It's like, no, this is a cautionary tale. This is and again, you're never quite sure who's the good guys or the bad guys by the end of it, all the way through. Every single page, it's like, wow, this is more complicated than you think. So there's my in-depth analysis. What is there any other thing that we wanted to say about this? Oh, yeah, and Rain on Dune, at the end of the movie, it's terrible. They all look up, and suddenly this rain starts pouring down.
Yeah, rain. Like, well, why?
Yeah, and you're like, what? Paul, what? This is not. This isn't Total Recall.
Where does this rain come from?
Yeah.
That and is a bit.
And you understand that in the book, it's like, yes, in the future there will be rain, and of course later on, in like by book three or book four, you know, Arrakis, the desert is just a very small desert.
And I think, I don't know the future books, but. You actually, at this point, you don't want Paul to be like the Messiah bringing the rain.
No.
You don't want him to be that, because you lose all the respect of this character, because you think, oh, no, he's no, you don't like him anymore at the end.
Yeah.
Really, that was what I felt. I felt
and in the movie, you're cheated,
I felt way more pity with the Emperor at the end, like, because it's like this old man, and then
and the new guy's like, just coming in going, bish bash bosh, you do that, I'm taking your daughter, okay, no, I'm taking your daughter, no, okay, you're not getting any more spice, and the Spice Guild will just cut daughter, off the capital city, and they're like, okay, I guess you can have my daughter.
And also, like, with Jessica and all these other people were more people I cared about than Paul. He was really like, oh, well, he's just arrogant.
Yeah, Paul becomes... It's Darth Vader's journey that you're looking at here. It's Anakin's journey. It's the rise of Darth Vader and the Emperor, rather than the success of Luke Skywalker. It's not like Obi-Wan Kenobi training Luke Skywalker and then him defeating the Emperor at the end. It's very much of like, oh, this is how we got the Emperor.
Yes.
You know, to do that. Talking more about analogies between Star Wars and Dune. Of course, Dune is a massive influence on Star Wars. You know, people, you know, everyone realized this. Well, I say anyone who has who'd read Dune and then watches the beginning of Star Wars on a desert planet, and even like stuff like the God Emperor of Dune, it's very much a Jabba the Hutt kind of figure, like a big worm thing with a human face kind of thing. You know, there's lots of different parallels there. Again, with the voice and when the Bene Gesserit kind of Jedi, I think in the what do they call it? The Jedi Bindu training or something in Star Wars, and it's you kind of see it's being taken from the same kind of, oh, we're a moisture farmer. It's like, where did you get the idea of moisture farmers? Dune, you know, you get moisture farmers. That's it. You've got these wet wind vanes that pick up moisture. Oh, a moisture farmer from out of here. It's like, yeah, okay. But the opposite way around, I saw this. This is what we're doing when we're watching Dune this time, because I've been there. I did my own edit, I did a whole new edit of Star Wars Episode One, A Phantom Menace, called the Silent Menace, which I will put links to sometime at some point. For copyright reasons, I don't want to just be sharing the link around, because I did like totally re-edit somebody else's movie. So anyway, editing this, I have watched Episode One and edited it throughout the editing many, many times, and I realized that it seems to be one of the main influences on Episode One, and maybe Episode Two and Three, is like the movie Dune. I don't think it is a main influence, but because I think they're using similar source material of, oh, we have an emperor, we have a princess, we have a hero, we have a desert, we have this and that.
We recognize like the clothes they're wearing. Like
I'm just saying the set design
is Bene Gesserit. They really look like Princess Amidala and all servants and and stuff. So yeah, we realized that. And also, what happened was there was a bit of the soundtrack where suddenly we started both there was the sequence, and then it suddenly sounded like
and we both started singing along, didn't we?
But now we want to talk about Dune.
Oh yeah, Dune. The idea of Dune being about ponderous trade agreements.
And a guild
of traders, and then go down to the planet and do this, and you've got the water people and the water planet, which is, you know, the Naboo, and you've got the big palaces, and you've got all the set design, and lots of people standing around in semicircles talking, and conference meetings, and you're like, oh, I see now. George Lucas probably wasn't basing that kind of stuff on the movie of Dune, but he was trying to create the same world as Dune, and in the original trilogy succeeded by concentrating on a hero's journey story throughout it, you know. But then in the prequels, he was just like, oh, we need big sets, we need big palaces, we need big spaceships, we need trade federations, we need trade guilds, we need this kind of stuff, we need desert plans. And he made all the mistakes that David Lynch made in his book. It's like, oh, we need of Dune. It's like, oh, we need Paul to fall in love with Shani. Oh, it's I love you. Let's get married, okay? And you just get the same thing happening in Episode Two with Anakin and Padme. It's like, I love you. I really, truly, deeply love you. And you're like, shoot me now. Hold me like you did on Naboo. It's like, don't you? Anyway, and all of these different like ponderous stuff of big trade treaties and politics. That's what George Lucas tried to do in the trilogy, and that's what David Lynch tried to do in a single movie. And it turns out both of them made the same mistakes. Because what you need to do is you just need to tell a personal story of one character, and that's what they do in the book. And then all of the other stuff, all of the other complicated factions, the other six factions, like in the board game, who's going to win? Oh, it turns out Atreides wins and everybody else loses. Or it could have, like, everybody else could have won if the Atreides lost, you know? Yeah. And that's the kind of, all these complexities, which you can do in a book, or you can do in a board game that takes 3.5 hours to play, or you can do in a miniseries, maybe, or you can do in a podcast, which takes 1.5 hours to...
We didn't watch the miniseries yet.
We didn't watch the miniseries.
We should do that too.
I really don't.
Yeah, after having so much Dune
stuff. Yeah, and
I'm a bit tired now.
We talk way too much about Star Wars and the Bible and Groundhog Day and music and all of these other topics. I think we should, after 1.5 hours chatting about Dune now, we can probably put this topic to bed.
Yeah.
Should we
but
say
actually, it's worth spending 1.5 hours on that book because it's so much
yeah,
in
you
it.
Can't spend less time than yes. that. I mean, I spent less time in my previous review because I didn't want to spoil it. So I was like, hey, here it is. Here's a setup. And I don't think I went into all of these extra ideas and theories, and I'm sure there's loads more. As soon as we press stop, we're like, oh, we were going to mention this, oh, we were going to mention that, oh, we're going to mention this, and there's loads of stuff that we still haven't mentioned. You know, we didn't even mention that, you know, the water ceremony and Alia and all of that kind of stuff. Oh yeah, that's what happens in the movie as well, where somebody goes, oh, and Jessica gave birth right away. It's like, no, wait a second.
Yeah, and also what happened in the movie was that it wasn't Paul himself drinking by his free will from this water. It was like he was forced to drink that water.
Yeah,
it was like they put straps around him.
Well, no, that was more for his safety. It's like, you know, when someone's going to give birth, you give them something to bite.
What?
I know, that's maybe donkeys. I can't remember. No, it's when you're chopping someone's leg off, you give them something to bite, like this thing.
Yeah,
like that. So
okay.
Yeah,
but
that's
it
what I
was totally
not,
totally
not giving birth.
I'm
getting mixed up there.
Totally wrongly.
Yes, and he goes and drinks the water of life, and this is the thing that like sets him on his final the final steps
like
of journey.
He
needs
totally
to know.
Crazy there.
He needs to know if he needs to have like better view into the future so he can see what's going to happen. And you realize that the only person who can't like that's what I was saying before about this Thayer Luther. The reason why he can't like navigate past him in time is because he also is of the same level of ability.
Yeah.
He is the other shortening of the way. So whoever wins this fight is going to be the next most important powerful person. You know, one of these two is going to marry the emperor's daughter and continue the emperor's line.
Yeah.
One of them is going to become the next thing, you know, or, you know, the Bene Gesserit going, oh, neither of them, and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, you realize that that's it. And that's why he took the water of life, but it was very much a personal thing that he did off his own back. And in the movie, it's like, okay, let's go out and we're going to do it in the middle of the desert. And then the sandworms, we've not even mentioned the sandworms once
yeah,
in this whole thing.
I mean, how you want to talk for 2 hours then?
No.
It's not. People who listen to or read it.
I actually really like the sandworms are obviously just one of the most amazing things. And the worms in the sand, even, you know, they pop up in movies, not just in Dune, but there's the movie Tremors. Have you seen Tremors?
No.
It's actually a really silly science fiction movie set in a desert, like in the Wild West, and there's these people start doing these drilling, and it wakes up these underground monsters which zip around underneath in the sand, and they've got like these, it's like Dune, you know, these sandworm kind of creatures, and it's just the idea of something just coming up out of the sand and swallowing you whole. And I really actually that's one of the most effective of pretty much the only effective shot in the entire movie is where there's the spice mining thing factory there, and it's massive, and you're like, well, how big are these worms really, and then you just see this massive mouth just come up out of the sand from underneath and go in slow motion, bite this
thing. But in the movie they make like a big explosion.
Yes, I'm just saying.
Actually, like in the book it's just like they just
but the sense,
swallow it and then it's gone.
But the sense of scale that you get from there is really good. And every other time that you see a worm in the entire movie, you just go, well, that's shit. You know,
yeah.
And they get chased by a worm and outrun a worm, and you're like, no, you don't outrun a worm. And then when Paul drinks the water of life, all these worms come and start like bowing down to him, and you're like, that wasn't
what?
In the book.
No.
I mean, I understand what he's going for with the messianic imagery there of the even the worms coming to pay homage to, you know, it's like the three kings coming and bowing down before Jesus, you know, at his birth.
It's
like the whole kind of paying homage to the new king.
I see,
but the worms doing it in the movie is just like, really?
Yeah.
Really? That's what we're going to go for? So,
okay. So we'll put that aside and for maybe a year we don't talk about Dune anymore.
Yeah, that's it. So I'm gonna stay by my There is stuff in this book which isn't great, but for the fact that I've now read it so many times, and we watched the movie, and we can talk about it for an hour and a half, you realise why we picked this book and Hyperion, because there's just so much to talk about in these books, and because of that, and because I can reconsume it by audiobook or ebook or paperbook or movie. I don't think I'll ever watch the movie again. That's twice now I've sat through that thing. I'm not going to do it again. But because of that, I've still got to rate it so highly, and because it's such an interesting story that you can kind of miss so many points to, and then get every time you read it, you get more points. And just, I say, the audiobook is really interesting, is really good as well, even though it's a bit confusing that you've got obviously an abridged full cast narration, plus the rest of it's filled in with other narration of a single guy. It took me like all year to work out the reason why, but it was because we were talking about the German abridgment and then the movie abridgment, and you realize some of it was taken. So I'm gonna stick with my 4.5 star rating out of 5. What are you gonna give it? A bit less than that? I mean, you have just read it twice in
yeah,
2 months.
Yeah, and otherwise a bit too much.
Yeah.
I would give it like a 3.5.
Really?
The highest, yeah.
So what's a 5-star book for you? Or have you not read a 5-star book?
I don't know. Not right now. Like, yeah. Just
off the top of your head.
Yeah.
How would you compare it to Hyperion, which is the previous book that we read before, the complexity of that, of the size
Actually,
of that
Hyperion
book?
Hyperion was better to me.
You liked it better?
Yes.
Yeah, it's because you didn't have to read.
Yeah, you didn't
have to read the next book. But that's a good thing. Is this one? This book is really great until you read the prequels, and you're just like, oh man, I wish I hadn't read the prequels. In fact, I think I read 6.5 of the prequel books, maybe more than that. I can't remember. But it's just a totally different book, and I like it that the sequels are totally different books again. Like Dune Messiah, I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before. It's like half of the people who like Dune will like Dune Messiah, and then half of the people who like Dune Messiah will like Children of Dune, and then half of the people who like Children of Dune will like that. So as you read on, you get down to like 1/32nd of the people will read all the way through to the end of the 6 Frank Herbert Dune books and like all of them. And I was one
which
of
which aren't really Frank Herbert, because then it's his son writing that.
No. He wrote 6 of them.
Oh,
and that's what I'm saying. Oh. And then of the people who read that, but the point is about the prequels is that you don't have to have read the sequels. You can just read Dune, and if you didn't like Dune Messiah and you just like the silly hero stuff and you don't like the complex political stuff, go back and read House Carino and House Atreides and House Harkonnen or whatever these other books are.
Yeah.
Which are fun enough, really not very good compared to Dune, but fun enough. The other prequels, the ones of the Butlerian Jihad. Yeah, we didn't even mention that there's no computers or robots or either. Like that
you did stuff. Mention that.
I think I'd mention it later. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah. So if you like Dune, read Dune Messiah, and then if you don't like it, stop, because there's no point going on. Just read as many books until you don't enjoy them anymore, and then stop, because there's no point reading on, because they do get... I think a good 4-book set is up to the end of The God Emperor of Dune, and then stop, because Chapter House Dune and the other one, the two at the end, are just not worth reading, I don't think. Anyway, so yeah, 3.5 stars, 4.5 stars, equaling out our... thing to there. So what else do we normally talk about here? Yeah, we go to goodreads.com and you can leave a comment on my review of Dune there. And also, if you sign up and become my friend on goodreads.com, when I look at goodreads.com and I look at Dune, for example, if I type into Goodreads, if I type, oh man, maybe I'll edit. Oh, we've gone long enough. So if I type in Dune here, and if I go to the Dune page, I can see all of the people who have listened to this. So I can see... Oh, it's not loading. Yeah, so 200 of my friends on goodreads.com have read and reviewed, and it's got a 4.26 average rating of people who listen to the SFBRP and read and have read Dune. So 4.26, that's pretty good. Yeah, it's a very highly rated book. Yeah, Joel 4 stars, Sandy 5 stars. Again, there's 200 reviews here, so I'm not going to read through all of them. Oh, lots of ratings. All the way down to Carl Bunker rated it 1 star. What book were you reading, Carl? Anyway, so yeah, sign up for goodreads.com and because I can then look through and see what you think about it, except Dune, because I'm not going to read through 200 reviews. So that's it from me. That's it from Julia. Say thank you and goodbye, Julia.
Thank you and goodbye, no, Luke.
Thanks for listening. Normally I say thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
The next book that we're gonna read together or review together will probably be in about another 2 months' time. Will be The Hobbit, because we went to watch The Hobbit and we really enjoyed The Hobbit.
And I will read it.
And because you never read it before. And we'll talk much more about The Hobbit. And we might even talk a little bit about Lord of the Rings as well in there. I actually have the Lord of the Rings book, which I was going to read at some point. But I've got so many other books to read. So I might as well not read a book again that I've already read twice before or something. So yes, we will talk about The Hobbit. And we'll also talk a little bit about our viewing of The Hobbit Unexpected Journey movie, which we... verdict on The Hobbit movie.
Pretty good.
I really enjoyed it. It's really good fun. We watched it in 3D, in high frame rate, in English, in the original language, with a break. And they tell you something, that break was very, very handy. Because for a 3-hour movie, it's really great in the movie theatre if everyone gets up and goes to the toilet at the same time, rather than having to sit through that kind of stuff. And yes, so that'll be good. We'll get to that in the future. Otherwise, that really is it. You can follow me on Twitter, I'm Luke Burge, and check out my website, lukeburge.com, or if you want to read a bit more about critical analysis of the Bible, sources in the Bible, and also the Star Wars movies and the prequels, you can check out productivebiblegeeks.net and check out Matthew, Mark, Luke, Skywalker there, and there's like 4 or 5 chapters up there already, and I'll be posting them weekly from now on. I'll mention it on future podcasts as well. So that really is it from me and Juliana. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Yay.